Once again, it is with great joyful emotions that we see those of us who are here this morning and those who hope to be here this evening. I'm grateful that the time of our separation has apparently ended, and I pray that the lesson that we study this morning will be helpful to us. I invite you to turn to Genesis 31. That will be our beginning point. Many years ago, an Atlantic passenger was deathly seasick. And in his bunk, he heard the shout that there was a man overboard. Someone had gotten lost in a pretty bad storm at sea, and that's what had caused the seasickness. And he thought, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm sick. But then he thought, maybe the least I can do is put a lantern in my portal. Well, he did. The man was rescued. And the next day, he related this story. He said, I was going down in the darkness for the last time when someone put a light in a porthole. It shone on my hand, and a sailor in a lifeboat grabbed it and pulled me in. A similar song, not about this, is Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. On an occasion when a ship was pulling into a harbor near Cleveland, and it was stormy, and they could see the lighthouse, but they couldn't see the lower lights that guided the ship in between the rocks. And they ended up crashing on the rocks. And they wrote the song, we have it as number 798, Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. Because we need God's light, like the lighthouse, and we need the lower light that will guide the people on into the way of safety. We want to study this morning on the subject of I can't help it, or I can do it. That comprises every one of us in one way or another, either for good or for bad. Weakness is no excuse for not doing what we can. Sometimes a person says, well, I can't do it perfectly, so I won't do it at all. Or I don't think I can do it, so I'm not even going to try. As a matter of fact, nobody does it perfectly. Only Jesus and the apostles by the Spirit, of course. The common excuse for losing a spiritual battle also is, I can't help it. It's just too great for me. I can't do anything about my struggles. They're too powerful to overcome. Some focus on their weakness and not on God's strength. So I'd like to study this for a moment. First, the negative, I can't help it, can become an excuse to lose. It's like the loser's limp. The man who limps because he didn't catch that man who just made the touchdown, but it's because he hurt his ankle, and he would have gotten him, but that's the loser's limp. It's an excuse, and it doesn't fool anybody. Now, in Genesis 31, Laban has chased Jacob and his wives and his children to Mount Gilead, and he's finally found them, and God has come to him, and he has told him, now, look, you better not say anything bad or good to Jacob, which is a euphemistic way of saying, you better watch what you say, because I'm going to judge you for how you treat my servant Jacob. He catches up to them and he says, well, what I want to know is, and this is Genesis 31:30, why did you steal my gods? He had some teraphim. Rachel had stolen those teraphim because her father had mistreated and cheated his own daughters and Jacob. And so they thought this was only fair. They would steal his teraphim. They're worth a lot in an idolatrous country. So she stole them. Jacob says, because I was afraid. But he says in 32, with whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. He didn't know Rachel had done this. So Laban went into Jacob's tent, to Leah's tent, the two maids' tents. And then in verse 34, he went into Rachel's tent. Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you. I cannot rise. You hear what she's saying? I'm in a position right now, health-wise, I cannot get up. But feel free to look all over the other place. And he didn't find his idols because she was sitting on them. We see that expression, I cannot, many times, like Rachel, because people are hiding a sin. Someone told me some time ago about a man who had been accused of a very serious sin. And he said, I'm not guilty. And someone said to him, I know what you can do. Take a lie detector test. And his response was, oh, I can't do that. And the man knew immediately, there's more to this than the man had let on. He was, in fact, guilty, as it turned out to be. Well, that's similar to Rachel here. In Ruth chapter 4, a few pages over, you'll see in chapter 4 that Boaz cannot take Ruth unless he first deals with this man who's closer kin to her than he is. And so they meet at the gate of the city. That's like going to the courthouse. And Boaz is talking to the close relative. And he says, I thought to inform you, verse 4, saying, buy it back, this land, buy this back, and you can redeem it. If you don't want to redeem it, I will. And the man said, well, I will redeem it, verse 4. And Boaz then in verse 5 drops kind of a bomb on this man. He says, now on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. You have to marry her. Leveret marriage, they called it. And at this point in verse 6, the close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem it. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself. I cannot redeem it. Twice he says, I cannot. We don't remember who this man is. Now, Boaz had Obed and Jesse and then David, four generations, and David became very famous. I doubt this man ever knew what he gave up. But the fact is, he did give up quite a bit. And I suggest to you, there are people who regret what they've done in the past. They made a decision. I wish I had done this. I wish I had done that. But then it's too late. They said, I cannot. Later, they wish they could. And they cannot. In Luke chapter 11, verse 7, we see another illustration of it. As it pertains to a man who is in bed, it's at night, and a friend knocks on his door at midnight, saying, lend me 3 loaves. That's Luke 11, verse 5. A friend of mine has come on his journey. I have nothing to set before him. And in verse 7, this man in bed will answer in this way. Do not trouble me. The door is now shut, and my children are with me in bed. Get this. I cannot rise and give to you. He cannot? Do the children hold him down? Is he stuck to the bed in some way? He cannot get up? No. Any parent who's had a child that cries at night knows you're not going to do anything to wake that child up and make that child cry. And that's what he's saying here. I cannot, because the cost to me is too great. I need my sleep. I won't even have to say any more about that. And then in Luke 16, just a few pages over, we have the famous account where there was a certain steward who was wasting his master's goods, and he is losing his position. So in verse 3, he starts to consider his situation. He said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. And then he says, I cannot dig. I could go out and get a job digging somewhere, but my hands just don't fit a grubbing hole or a shovel. I don't have any option like that. I cannot dig. I'm ashamed to beg. He wasn't ashamed to steal from his master, but he was ashamed to work menial labor. Someone has said that work prevents 3 great evils: boredom, vice, and need. This man had to do it the conniving way instead of the working way. But let's hurry on to this now. I can do all things, a reason to win. The Christian, unlike the loser's limp, who's looking for a way to excuse disobedience or failure, the Christian is looking for a way to succeed. We want to go to heaven. We want as many others to go to heaven with us as can possibly be. We're looking for a way, a reason to win. Let me suggest a half dozen things we need to do in order to accomplish this and to show that we have this right attitude. Number 1, we can change our priorities. I ask you to go with me to Matthew chapter 22 and the greatest of all the commandments. Now, this is not even mentioned in the Ten Commandments. There is no commandment that says what Jesus says here. And yet this one commandment summarizes everything that God wants his people to be and what he wants them to do. The Pharisees in verse 34 heard that he had silenced the Sadducees. They gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, now this is Matthew 22:36. Teacher, Which is the great commandment in the law? That was a common subject of debate among the Jewish scholars. Which one is the greatest of all the commandments? Jesus deals with it like this in verse 37. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." This is the first and great commandment. Everything else flows from this, including the second one, you love your neighbor as yourself. That's found in Leviticus, of all places, where they're talking about the priesthood and the offerings they would make. But the greatest of all is this love. And then second, the love for the neighbor. Now, this is the greatest commandment. If it's the greatest commandment, it deserves the greatest priority. Notice what he didn't say. The Lord didn't say, the greatest commandment is obey God. Now, there would have been nothing wrong with that. That's true. Except it's not the greatest commandment. The greatest is love. Let me illustrate it this way. A soldier has a drill instructor who has it in for him. Day after day, he'll have him dig a hole and fill it up just to punish him for some little thing. He's always looking for something to do to punish him. He obeys meticulously. He does everything the sergeant wanted him to do. But the day will come when he's released from the service, and if he were to be walking down the street and he were to happen to look up and see his sergeant slumped over with a heart attack in his car, he wouldn't even cross the street to help him. Wouldn't even think about going over to help him. Let him die. He obeyed him, but there was no love in his heart. I have told you previously about a friend of mine who went through a very terrible situation similar to this in the drill instructor in preparation for World War II. And just as he was ready to be shipped out, he got up on the truck and he saw this man who had given him such misery. And he said, "Sarge, I wish you were going with us." And he said, "Why is that?" He said, "Because if you were, I would shoot you." And at that time, he would have. He became a totally different man. Now, he obeyed him, but he didn't love him. But love will do all of this. It will obey, but it will do it from the proper motive, and even when no one would expect him to do it. Jesus loved even his enemies. So that's more than obedience involved. A second part of this, love is one of the strongest forces we have in the universe. How else could you explain a mother in a burning house refusing to come out until she finds her little child somewhere in that building? And she's willing to risk damage to her lungs. She's willing to risk burns. She's willing to risk death itself in order to find that child. And we see all kinds of illustrations of people who would die to save someone else because of love. This is a very, very powerful concept. Now, one of the illustrations of this is in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Every time I read this, I realize I can never do justice to explaining it. I can never do justice even to comprehending it. But what is happening here in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, that's a unit. Paul is talking about the great contribution for the poor saints in Jerusalem. And there were those in other areas who were sending funds. Gentiles were sending funds to the Jews because the Jews had sent them the gospel and they appreciate what has happened. So he begins with an example of giving. He doesn't start by saying, in chapter 8, he doesn't start by saying, "Now, I want you Corinthians to get your money ready and send it to the folks in Jerusalem." He'll get around to that. But he doesn't start that way. He starts with an example in the first five verses. And he'll go on to give the chiefest example in verse 9, but that's for another day. In verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia." Now that's an interesting expression. When you consider this example he gives here, in his second journey, Acts 15, 36 to 18, 22, that's his second journey. He goes to Philippi. He then goes to Thessalonica. He then goes to Berea and establishes churches in that northern region. Now, this northern region was looked down upon by the people, the Christians, even in the southern region. That would be Athens, but especially Corinth in Achaia. They looked up at those in the north and said, we don't want anything to do with them. So in this region up here, here's Philippi. He goes through Amphipolis and Apollonia, then comes to Thessalonica, then to Berea. They called these people in this area barbarians. The barbaric north is what they called them. Of all things, Paul uses these people that the Corinthians would have called barbarians to show the Corinthians what they need to be doing, because these barbarians up here have done better than anybody Paul knows. They've set the best example he's ever seen of showing this kind of love. So Paul uses the Macedonians to teach Corinth? That is incredible. That's like taking a fellow who lives in a slum and doesn't have a dime to his name to teach a man who has millions of dollars. What can he teach that man, right? That's how they feel spiritually here. In verse 1, I want you to know about the grace of God. But he doesn't stop there. It's the grace of God bestowed on these churches of the barbarians, as you would call them. Look what God has done to these barbarians to have them act this way. Later in verse 7, he will say, but as you abound in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge and all diligence and your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. And that would be the grace of giving. And in verse 9, he uses the greatest illustration of all. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. The grace of God is the grace of giving based upon God's greatest gift. Look how God's grace affected these people in the barbaric north, is what he's saying. Someone told me years ago, I had lived in Coffee County for 9 years, and I knew a man there very, very well, respected him highly, meek, kind, gentle soul. He said, you know, in his younger days, he was rough. He said, there was an occasion when he got into an argument with somebody, I think it was in Woodbury, maybe some 15 miles away. And he strapped on his guns and was ready to go have a gunfight with him. And he said, I'm Wild Bill from Nat Hill. And I said, wait a minute, you're talking about this man? And he said, yes, this man used to be that way. But he had changed so much upon becoming a Christian. You wouldn't have known they were the same people. These are two totally different people. That's what Paul is saying here. These people up here that you call barbarians, they're not like you think they are. They have totally changed. The grace of God got a hold of them and transformed them into totally different creatures. That's what verse 1 here is telling us. In verse 2, the Thessalonians face great obstacles, two great obstacles in their giving. One was, he said, in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. The persecution that they received, Paul refers to in Thessalonians. But the persecution is something that had been going on for years. They had had a number of issues through the years on the part of Rome and others picking on these people. But now that they've become Christians, they have added issues. Furthermore, the extreme poverty, two things primarily historians tell us are the cause of this. The civil wars that they had had. You notice what one civil war did to this nation and how it was in poverty for quite some time. Civil wars, and then the second was the Roman plunders. They had rich deposits of ore and things, and the Roman government sent people regularly to rob that of these people in the barbaric north. And so you have then this great trial of affliction, this tribulation, this distress they're under. Who could expect them to be good givers? They're doing as best they can to keep soul and body together, right? And then the extreme poverty. Verse 9, that same poverty is used of the poverty that Christ accepted in order to become rich. Now, how much did Jesus own on this earth as a human? Did he have a house? No, he had to borrow that. Did he have a tomb, a good burial plot? Had to borrow everything he had, didn't he? had to borrow everything he had. That's extreme poverty. There's a word for poor, then there's a word for poverty. This is the word for poverty that's used of Christ, and it's the same one used of the people in the barbaric north. He says they're deep poverty in verse 2. It's the word that's used in Matthew 19, 21, when Jesus is talking to the rich young ruler. He says, I've done all these things. What do I lack yet? Matthew 19, 21, he says, if you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor. The word poor there means those who are poverty stricken, just like this. And you'll have treasure in heaven and come follow me. And yet, these items, this persecution, this poverty, did not quench their charity. Rich people can be generous, but they show that poor people can be generous. These are people in poverty who are giving to people in poverty. The poverty-stricken Macedonians are giving to the poverty-stricken folks in Jerusalem. Interesting. One beggar helps another. Who's heard of that? And then in verse 3, for I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing. Well, that's a strange expression. Suppose I told you I can jump 4 feet. You just stand flat footed, just jump 4 feet in the air. You say, well, is that the best you can do? And I say, no time. No, sometimes I can jump 5 feet if I'm scared. We see there's a possibility of doing as much as you can, but certain conditions bring out more than you can. And I believe that's what he's saying here. What does this mean that beyond their ability? How can you give beyond your ability? Can you jump higher than you can jump? Well, could it be they would be forced to borrow to give this and then pay it back? Could it be they would be going into more debt? Could it be they're going to miss meals? Could it even be that, like Jesus said to the rich young ruler, go sell what you have, that they were willing to sell some of their items, though they're in poverty. Sell some of the items, maybe even necessities, to help these people who had brought them the gospel. So grateful are they for the grace of God that has come to them. I don't know exactly what is involved, but in any way you view it, it is spectacular in the charity. And then verse 3 shows also this is their decision. According to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, entirely on their own is what that means. So then in verse 4, imploring us. They're begging us to let them give, Paul says. Paul says, you are too poor. You don't need to do this. You're going to make yourself so poor, we'll have to help you. No, we demand the right to help them, that we would receive the gift in the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. This is incredible. The only pressure here is the pressure of their choice. We demand the choice to be able to give. And then verse 5, the conviction. And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves. What's the first commandment? Love. Being interpreted, that's what this is. They first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. They went from A to Z, from aliens to zealous in the cause of Christ, because they had the proper priorities. Now, number 2, not only can we change our priorities in life, we can allow the Bible to have its way with us. Joshua 1:8, of all places, gives us an excellent illustration of this attitude. God is talking to Joshua, getting him prepared for the great campaign that lies ahead of him. And he said, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. What does it mean, it shall not depart from your mouth? They read out loud typically. So he's saying, you're to spend time with this book. This thing's to be in your mouth regularly. Furthermore, you're to meditate on it, not just learn it, but keep it up there. Keep going over it. That's what changes you. You do it day and night. It's not just one Bible period a day. A person says, well, I studied 10 minutes this morning. That's enough. Not for these. Not for Joshua. That you may observe to do. There's the purpose. Not just learning it, but obeying it. So there's 4 points in this one verse for some of you who want a sermon outline. According to all that is written in it. Merely knowing what to do is not enough. A doctor may tell a person, I want you to go home, diet, quit smoking, and quit drinking. Now, he has his knowledge. He knows what to do. What's the issue? The issue is, will he do it? And that's what's being thrown out here. Let me ask you to turn to Numbers 13 and 14. Those passages ring a bell as soon as I say them. I know, because these are the great passages that show the great unbelief of the children of Israel when God was ready to send them into the promised land. Remember, the 10 spies said, we cannot do this. Israel fears giants. We cannot go up into the promised land because the fine print says there are giants there, and God didn't tell us about that. Well, fast forward over to Numbers 21. The new generation has come along. The old generation has all but died out. They're ready to go up. They're going to have to circle around Edom and come in from the eastern side across the Jordan. And it tells us as they did so, the people murmured. They spoke against God and Moses. That's Numbers 21:5. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt? That's what their fathers had said. And you see where it got them. And now they're repeating the sins of their fathers. There's no food, no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people. He says, you want to be in misery? Then I'll give you your wish. Here are some serpents. How you handle that? They bit the people. Many of them died. So I would imagine that the ones who were complainers died and the others learned their lesson. Immediately in verse 7, they said, we've sinned. And pray now to the Lord that he'll take away the serpents. Now, he didn't take away the serpents, but he did give a remedy. And the remedy is, he says in verse 8, make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten when he looks at it shall live. When Christ came, he didn't take away sin, but he gave us a remedy for it. And it's the same way here. And so, verse 9, Moses made a bronze serpent, put it on a pole. And so it was, if a serpent had bitten anyone when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. He not only lived, but he learned a major lesson. Don't criticize God. Don't complain against God. Be grateful for what you have and be faithful and anticipate what is coming. The glorious land you await is there before you. Don't blow it like your forefathers did. Now, a new generation, but they're not perfect, are they? Now look at what God tells them to do next. This is fascinating to me. In Numbers 21, they ask in verse 21, Sihon, king of the Amorites, if they could pass through his land. He said no. And in fact, he's hostile. Verse 23, he would not allow them, but he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. What did Israel do? Defeated him with the edge of the sword, took possession of his land. That gave them part of the land they enjoyed on the east side of the Jordan River. Then he goes on to tell us about another episode in verse 33. King Og, who's also on that eastern side. Verse 33. They turned and went up by the way to Bashan. So Og, king of Bashan, went out against them. He and all his people to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said to Moses, do not fear him, for I have delivered him into your hand with all his people and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt at Heshbon. They defeated him, his sons, and all his people until there was no survivor left him, and they took possession of his land. Deuteronomy 3, verse 11 tells us Og was a giant. What was the argument of the unbelieving spies, the 10 spies? We can't take this land. One of them was, there are giants there. What's the first thing God does before they have a battle in Israel? They have a battle before they even enter, and it's with a giant. And then Joshua shows there are other giants they have to fight with. They call them the Anakim and the Rephaim, those two words. And there are giants awaiting them in the land of Canaan, and they mow them down like a mowing blade cuts down the hay. They were nothing because the power of God was with them. There's nothing they couldn't do if they were willing to follow God's words. This is total victory. So I suggest to you, people must learn through him that we can conquer. Luke 10, verse 37, this lawyer says to Jesus, well, you've told me to love my neighbor, but who is my neighbor? Now I've got you, right? They argued about that a lot. Who is my neighbor? And he tells about the Samaritan. He went out and he helped someone he didn't even know. He said, now, which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan? Well, the Samaritan. He said, well, just go and do what he did. Just go and do what he did. In other words, you don't need more information. You don't need to debate this. You don't need to get other opinions. You just need to do it. And that's what this is telling us. We can, like Joshua 1:8, allow the Bible to have its way with us, or we can argue with it. We can try to circumvent it. We can ignore it. But it's not going away. We will face it. Number three, we can depend upon the power of God. There's no temptation that comes to us, but such as is common to man. But God will not allow you to be tempted above your ability to bear it. We can bear it. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. May I say to you that many passages teach this thought. It runs like a thread. In 2 Peter 2, at verse 9, for example. 2 Peter 2 is giving some illustrations about what God did for His people, how He rescued His people, how they became strong when they followed Him. In verse 9, He makes this comment after speaking of Lot. The Lord knows how. So the Lord knows how to do something. What is it? To deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. I spoke on that verse probably 20 years ago. And in the audience was a man and a woman, both of whom were given to extreme views, wanting to stretch the Bible as far as they could stretch it to do whatever they could make it do. And of all things, they highly complimented what I said in 2 Peter 2:9. I thought, well, I've done something wrong here. Why would they compliment this? Why would they praise that lesson? And then it finally occurred to me, they probably think this verse says God will not let you get into a situation. If you're one of His children, He won't let you get into a situation where you're practicing error. So what we're doing and what we're advocating must be true because He's not punished us in any way. I think that's probably where they were coming from. But that overlooks quite a few things. Look at Lot. Look how Lot suffered. He was vexed daily. Look at the angels who fell. God could have preserved every angel if 2 Peter 2:9 means what that couple wanted it to mean. But that's not what it means. It's calling us to accountability. Just as the angels were accountable, the pre-flood people fell. God could have saved all those with Noah. But all of them fell except Noah and his family. The Sodomites, the same way. Lot lost Mrs. Lot. Now, why wasn't she saved? Look at 2 Peter 2, the first three verses. These alone are enough to show this is all conditioned upon our response to God's Word. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. Why is he giving that warning? There were false prophets, now there are false teachers. Beware, because we can resist. But if we don't resist, they'll get us like they got those. That's his illustration of judgment. And then we can conquer temptation. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. I heard a few years ago about 21 people who died in a Chicago nightclub. People at the wrong place at the wrong time. I heard about 96 in Rhode Island a few days after who died in a nightclub. People in the wrong place at the wrong time. They could possibly be alive today had they avoided the wrong crowd. Now think about it. Agoraphobia, fear of crowds. We don't want agoraphobia, but there are some crowds we ought to be afraid of, because they not only can damage us physically, they can destroy us spiritually. Hebrews 11:7, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Now, there's not a word here about peer pressure. There's not a word here about how Noah had an easy life. Oh, I wish things were easier. Building an ark, that's not easy. What we do see is that his conduct judged their sins. And I suggest to you that worldly people love compromisers. And if Noah had compromised, the people around him would have loved him, but they all would have perished together, wouldn't they? Somebody has to stand for the truth. I saw a several years ago, a former NFL football player, who has such pain in his back from all the hits he incurred over the years that it takes him 5 minutes every morning to put his pants on. He has to prop himself up against a wall and finally manage to get one foot through that leg and the other foot through that leg and gradually pull him up in 5 minutes. And they asked him, was it worth it? Was going through that football, getting those hits and having this result, was it worth it? He says, yes. They said, why? Why was it worth it? He says, because of the applause. The applause was worth it. Now, that's fine for him. But how many people do we know, because of applause, who sell their souls? It will not be worth it. Number five, we can take one day at a time. Jesus points this out in Matthew 6. For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. Verse 33, but seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. How do you climb a mountain? One step at a time. How do you live and continue to thrive in the Lord? One day at a time. That's what He's telling us. Personal Bible study. How do we grow? We do it one day at a time. We do it one step at a time. That's how we grow. Then number six, we can replace bad habits with good ones. Matthew 12:43, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest and finds none. Then he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it, get this, empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself. And they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be also with this wicked generation. When he finds it empty, swept, and put in order, that's called a relapse. When it says that he finds seven other spirits more wicked that he invites in, that's a worse state than before. That's the way sin does. A relapse makes it worse. Nature hates a vacuum. A full bottle keeps the air out, but nature hates a vacuum. Our life is not a spiritual void. Something will fill it, either good or evil. Ephesians 4:22, that you put off your former conduct, the old man that is corrupt. 23, be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on, verse 24, the new man which was created in God in true righteousness and holiness. You put off, you put on, you replace. You don't just leave a void. The context goes on to explain. Ovid said, nothing is stronger than a habit. If it's a good habit, that's good. But if it's a bad habit, that's terrible. But the context here goes on to talk about changing their habits, and it gets very specific. Lying, anger, stealing, language, bitterness, malice, and so on. Now, the ancient people used a Latin expression to describe how a Christian should live based on passages. I'd like to speak on this one of these days, the Lord willing, but just two verses here. This Cormdell just basically means in the presence of God. We are to live our lives with the knowledge that God is watching us. We are in His presence, even here. And if we live with that in mind, we don't have to look over our shoulder to see who else is watching. God is always watching. And that helps us govern ourselves. Two verses on this. In Genesis 6:11, the earth also was corrupt before God. They're in His sight. He sees what they're doing. He hears what they say. He observes their evil works. They're not getting by with anything. Though He hasn't done anything yet, they're not getting by with a thing, as the context goes on to show with the flood. And I suggest to you that in Acts 10:33, one of the great opposites to what we just saw in Genesis 6, Cornelius says, now therefore we are all present before God. Cornelius, a Gentile, not even a Christian yet, has such insight that he says, I realize we're in the presence of God, even Peter, as you speak to me. We're here before God to hear all things commanded you by God. I think that would temper our attitudes, make us more focused on what we need to be, what we need to do. If you owe the Lord a duty, if you need to respond in any way to His will, Thank you for listening, but come if you need as we stand to sing.